Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, and I'm very pleased today to have on my show somebody who I think our viewers are going to be interested in listening to. He's going to talk a lot about President Trump's proposed policies, especially on tariffs, which we're all interested in and trying to work through. I've had some people on that have been critical, and I think my guest today is going to offer a different viewpoint that I think we need to hear. His name is Richard Porter, and he's the former Illinois National Committeeman to the Republican National Committee, and I'm very pleased to have him on today. Richard, thank you for taking the time.
Absolutely. It's great to be here.
Well, I saw a piece you had written for Real Clear Politics, and I heard an interview, and I thought this is something I'd like to get in front of my listeners. I know they're getting a lot of critiques of this policy. I want to just have you discuss it in terms of me, because I'm interested in this as well. Been a lot of controversy, obviously, about it. The economy's taken a hit, but what do you see? President Trump's purpose here in instituting these broad tariffs around the world? Kind of give us a little background and maybe what you think he's trying to accomplish.
Well, I think the thing to recognize about the tariff policy is he's trying to achieve several goals, some of which are actually inconsistent, and so I think that it's a very pragmatic thing that he's going about doing, and where it ends up will depend somewhat on a country-by-country basis, industry-by-industry, based on these conflicting goals. So one of the things he's emphasized from the very beginning of his very first candidacy was the need to reindustrialize the American heartland. And his view, and I think it's a view that's been consistent on the populist right for some time, is that the implementation of pure financial theories around free trade have had really the adverse effect on middle-income industrial workers, plant workers. And in his first term, he imposed some steel tariffs that had really a beneficial effect getting some steel plants opened, including in south-central Illinois, putting a lot of folks back to work in high-wage, high-quality jobs in the steel plants. And I think he recognizes that the tariff, the power to impose tariffs, gives him a lever because the U.S. economy is so strong. It's a marketplace, if you will, that every country needs to be in. And that ability to control the access to the United States and basically the rent, if you will, what it costs to get into the U.S. market, gives him leverage to get other things done. So one, having higher tariffs means that it's more expensive to bring things in from overseas. It's less expensive to build things in the U.S., relatively speaking. And so having higher tariffs creates an incentive for businesses to open plants in the United States again. That was the steel tariff. It also generates revenue, which takes pressure off the income tax. So maybe you can replace some of the income tax with revenue from importers. But you can also use it as a tool to get countries to do other things. And we saw that right out of the box in the second inauguration. We reached out to Canada and Mexico, imposed very high tariffs, but for the purpose of getting them to change behavior on something unrelated to trade, which was to stop the flow of fentanyl. So once he got the cooperation around that and immigration, he dropped those tariffs. So it was a threat, which he then pulled off the table to get them to change their behavior on something other than trade. And then finally, with the reciprocal tariffs, one of his goals there is to get other countries to change their policies with regard to trade, to make it easier for our exporters, these industries in the United States, which we're trying to build up, to have markets for them for their goods and over in other overseas markets. Now, that's a little inconsistent because what we're basically saying to countries is we've put up these new tariffs. They're high. We're matching what you've done to us. We'll take them down if you take yours down, right? Which means you're moving towards more free trade, lower tariffs, right? And so it's a little different than the goal in some of the other tariff moves that he's made. And we've already seen in a number of circumstances, South Korea, Israel, Vietnam, India, they've reached out, I think up to 70 countries now have reached out and said, we will lower our tariffs, we'll lower our non-tariff trade barriers in exchange for reducing these new reciprocal tariffs. And, you know, so the complexity about this, I think one of the reasons why the market is reacting the way it's reacting is there's just uncertainty around where we're going to end up. I mean, the good news is everyone but China has reacted positively to this, positively in the sense of saying, hey, we'll come talk, we'll reduce our barriers, we're going to create more opportunities for U.S. goods. Israel said yesterday, we're going to eliminate the U.S., you know, the trade barrier, the trade deficit with the United States. So a lot of positive movement. China, however, has kind of said they're going to go to war. They increased their tariffs. They were already higher tariffs than ours in the first instance. The president today, you know, responded with 104% total tariff going into effect tomorrow against Chinese goods, which is, you know, it becomes almost exclusionary. And we get so much trade with China. You know, this is, you know, it's a little bit of a game of chicken, if you will, getting them to kind of redress where they are. Let me step back for a second, because one of the things important for people to understand is coming out of World War II, we had a theoretical approach to the rest of the world, which was epitomized by the Marshall Plan, where we recognized the world was destroyed, you know, that the industrial capacity of our friends and allies were destroyed. We actually gave money to them to help them rebuild. But on top of that, we allowed a trading system to develop where there was protectionist tariffs with our developed friends that we didn't have. So we had low tariffs. They had higher tariffs. And that's one of the reasons why the U.S. auto business has never been able to ship into Germany or to France or into Japan. And so that's persisted now for 70 years. And so there's a broader foreign policy objective the president's trying to achieve here, which is shifting from the U.S. as a donor nation to everybody else, where we basically were buying friends by supporting their militaries. You know, we oversupply to NATO. We gave generous trade terms. And we're basically saying, look, we're going to level the playing field. Whether it's in NATO, everybody carries their own weight. We're on trade. We're going to match your trade barriers if you don't lower yours. So that dynamic is going on as well. So he has this tool, this lever, and he's using it for a lot of different things. It's a hammer, if you will, and he's fixing all sorts of elements of where we are with the same tool, but for different purposes.
As you know, these issues get caught up immediately in political dynamics, and we're so partisan, hyper-partisan, that, you know, the Republicans have shifted. I'm old enough to remember under Reagan when the Republicans were more the free trade party. The Democrats were somewhat free trade, but had more trade skeptics. And the Republicans, well, they did too. But now it's just amazing what's happened. But the truth is, if you dig in on this, and I know you're aware of this, there are some real unfair comparisons in trade practices. I read in the Financial Times, for example, Europe puts a 10% tariff on our vehicles, but yet ours is 2.5%.
Right.
Well, that's not really fair. And I go out and talk to people and they hear that and they're like, well, that's not right. I think there's a large degree where the public just isn't aware of some of the unfairness out there. And I think you've mentioned some of it. There are other examples that you're aware of like that, where if the public heard and they go, well, wait a minute. Okay, I get it. I understand why we're doing this now.
You know, the European agriculture market, for example, is very protected by high tariffs. And so, and they also have non-tariff rules around GMO and stuff like that that impact our ability to ship agricultural products into the entire EU. So that you're right. I mean, this kind of goes to the point that the system was set up where we allowed our friends to have barriers that we wouldn't have ourselves. And so one of the really positive effects we're seeing already is the willingness of other countries to address at least some of those imbalances and unfair practices. India, for example, is a very protected market. It's very difficult for U.S. business to enter the Indian marketplace, you know, whether it's the tariffs or the non-tariff barriers. It's a huge market. It's a growing market. And they've already indicated their willingness to address some of these things. And so I think that's the positive we've seen already with regard to the reciprocal tariffs.
Yeah. And I guess my feeling is, you know, there is a balance on trade we have to approach. I mean, in our region, the Quad Cities was just the subject of a Wall Street Journal article talking about our dependence on trade, John Deere, our farmers. But also, you get out to area near where I live, Galesburg lost a Maytag refrigeration factory that moved to Mexico. Burlington's lost, had factories leave. So we've witnessed this deindustrialization out here that really, I think, you know, in my opinion anyway, was really unfair, where, again, the playing field wasn't level. And I think what the president's trying to do is address this. And again, I'm just asking for, I guess, fairness in how this is presented to the public. And I like the way you've done it in trying to give this a fair hearing, so to speak, based on the past, what's happened.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because we all live our lives and experience different aspects of it. If you're living in New York or in finance, you just don't experience the real world impact of a plant closing in the Quad Cities. It's just relatively meaningless to you. And this is the point, which is, I think, that Donald Trump has touched into, which is theories don't put their kids to bed at night, right? Our neighbors do. And that's what it means to put America first. For the government, yes, we want to have free policy because it leads to greater prosperity. That's true. But we have to have an overlay of pragmatism around that, recognizing that there are real-world impacts to that, and that maybe some of the unfairness of the system is what's leading to these results, not just free trade policies. And so we need to be aware of that and adjust accordingly. You can't just be in a straitjacket around free trade or any other theory, frankly. You need to recognize and be pragmatic about how it actually plays out in the real world. And you're more likely to do that if you experience the pain and the dislocation of a plant closing, right? And frankly, sometimes these plants are closing because of bad regulations in the government, which are causing our costs to go up. And so it isn't just a question of the relative cost of labor or, you know, the supply of goods. Sometimes we're doing this to ourselves. And we've seen that. For example, it's kind of crazy to think that we haven't had a gunpowder plant in the United States since 1985. Now, apparently one's being constructed, I think, in Tennessee or Kentucky, I forget what it is now, but it's remarkable to think that here we're the world's superpower. And of course, we've been dropping a lot of bombs, you know, over the last 30 years, but we're not actually making any gunpowder. Well, that's nuts. That's nuts. The idea that the pharmaceuticals that we need to address things like a pandemic, that they're all made in China, that's nuts, because we see China doesn't necessarily share our view of freedom and openness. And, you know, we can't count on them as being an ally. And so we need to be aware of the consequences of our policies and recognize that we need to have strategic things that make us a great superpower made here. And we have to recognize the economic impact on our friends and neighbors and bear that into account. And it may not just be a tariff issue. It may actually be a regulatory issue. It may be something else the government is doing that's making life too hard for our businesses and our workers to succeed. So, you know, look, there's been too much focus for too long on things other than what work for the American people. This is why Donald Trump has been so successful. He taps into that. He's able to understand and express and fight for people who don't live in the coasts, who have an experience that's different than what a guy in New York finance would experience. That's the funny thing about where the parties are today. People used to talk about the Republicans as the country club party or the party of rich people. No. I mean, the interesting thing is today the Democrats are the party of the rich Eastern elites, Eastern and Western elites. That's their base. And Donald Trump and the Republican Party has become the party of really the working men and women, the small businessmen, the laborer, you know, the members of the unions. The union structures themselves still lean to the Democrats, but the members of the industrial unions, at least, are voting for Republicans because the Republicans are fighting for policies that will lead to more jobs and higher wages.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Richard Porter, who is a former Illinois committeeman to the Republican National Committee. Richard's talking today. We're having a discussion about President Trump's tariffs. It's a nice civil discussion. We're trying to give a full look at this issue in a fair way and provide a little history, because my feeling anyway is I get kind of the purpose of these, and you can disagree with maybe how he's going about it and somewhat some, you know, the unpredictability day to day. But there's a lot of history that goes into this and facts that I think people aren't aware of. And Richard's been kind of filling in listeners today, which I appreciate. The fact is, we are the biggest market in the world. And as you said, in the wake of World War II, I was just reading this yesterday, we helped build, it's a signal of, I think, our country's greatness. We helped build up our adversaries. But then Japan got an industrial capacity and immediately started underselling our vehicles. I'm old enough, for our listeners who know, to remember that in the 1970s. Now China is doing this as well, blatantly cheating. I don't think that's too strong a language at all. I guess I see this as kind of a battle that's been brewing a long time, especially with China, and it's in the president has engaged it. Any thoughts on how this might end up? Are we going to have kind of a semi-permanent trade war, so to speak, with China, or do you think this might lead to some type of agreement that might involve other behavior that China's involved in, as far as threatening Taiwan?
I think we already are seeing that almost all of our trading partners are coming to the table, and we're going to see a very rapid, I think, 60 to 90 day period of time where there's going to be a flurry of renegotiation of trade terms, tariff levels, non-tariff barriers in different countries. Every country is going to be a little different. I mean, the workload is sort of mind-boggling. And because it's a pragmatic plan, it's not really driven by an overall or overarching theoretical construct, the president's going to be involved in a lot of these negotiations. He was back and forth with the South Korean president, for example. He reported that on Truth Social earlier today. And so I think the outlines of these deals will be struck between the president and the leaders of, you know, it's going to be like 70 countries we're going to be talking to. And I think that's already unfolding, and that's going to be a flurry. Now, the big Megillah is China, and they are one of the biggest trade malefactors. They've been a bad actor. They've been a good partner in a lot of things, but they've also been a real challenge in terms of like stealing our intellectual property. And you know, it's an authoritarian, communist controlled regime, and so that makes it inherently unstable and uncertain. They own a lot of our bonds, so they have some impact on our currency. The yuan today, the Chinese currency, say broke. It came out of the kind of prescribed band that it was trading in, and so the yuan was devalued, which has the impact of making the purchasing power of all the Chinese citizens lower as a result of this struggle between the chairman of the Communist Party, leader of China, Xi, and Donald Trump. When Trump is now, you know, Xi responded negatively to the challenge from President on Liberation Day. They slapped on an additional tariff. The president's come back. Now it's going to be 104% as of tomorrow night. The productive thing to do is get on the phone and start working things out. And I think the president has made it so clear. They were saying again today, if we can work something out, they'd look forward to having a gracious arrangement with the communist leader. But I think China views itself as the next kind of global superpower. And so to some extent, this is going to end up being a contest of wills over sort of who is going to be the leading nation of the world. And I think it's a really important contest. And this has been brewing for some time. China, going back thousands of years, viewed themselves as the dominant civilization. And their culture is completely different. It's a communist regime. And you know, what they offer ultimately is a communist perspective on the role and the relationship between government and the citizens. And we still offer the idea of government of, by, and for the people, which, by the way, Donald Trump is refreshing. When you talk about populism, that's what this is. Thomas Jefferson was a populist. Abraham Lincoln, who who talked about refreshing government of, by, and for the people, was a populist. He fought the kind of established regime, which was based on slavery. You know, people forget this. And so this is a refreshing of that culture that Donald Trump is going through. And it's a contest between two different visions of how governments ought to relate to their people for the rest of the world. So this is really a big deal. It's a little scary. I mean, I won't kid you. I mean, the market came off again today after the president imposed 104% tariffs. I mean, this, you know, these are uncertain times. But he's taking on something at a period of time when the economy has been strong. We're not doing this is not 1930. You know, we didn't have a crash. There is uncertainty that's being created by this, but it's because there's a rejiggering of the relationships. And when you do that, there's always uncertainty. So when in private equity and in investing, there's a concept called the J curve, the J curve. What that means is often when you take over a company or you make a new investment in a business, when it involves changing the strategy or expanding a market, there's uncertainty because you're putting more money in without an immediate return. And so that's when the value of the company may dip for some period of time. But you do that in order to get yourself onto a different growth trajectory that increases the rate of growth. And I think that's what Donald Trump is trying to do. He's willing to take a risk for short-term uncertainty in order to achieve a longer-term or really an intermediate-term change in our growth trajectory. One other factor I want to kind of throw out there, because I think this is sort of in the background that we're not focused on yet, which is the rise of AI, artificial intelligence, and the impact that artificial intelligence will have on how Americans and all, you know, people around the world work. And AI will affect how we work. It's going to change our productivity. And changing productivity means each individual worker can do more with fewer workers. I mean, so everybody does more, you don't need as many workers. Now, that could lead to unemployment. That's the sort of dislocation when you look at other epochs in American history. It went from an agricultural base to industrialization and then the modern technological revolution. It changes the nature of employment. And this is one of the important things to recognize is that when we're cutting off immigration, so the supply of labor into the country slows down, and we're increasing demand for American workers by reshoring industrial production to the United States, you're creating a demand for labor here that you say, well, gee, the supply, is it going to match the demand? Well, there's two things that you recognize about that. When the demand increases and the supply stays constant, that means wages go up. So it's a way to drive wages for the middle-income worker. But the other effect is recognizing that 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the line, the amount of produce that each individual worker can produce as a result of AI will increase, which means the demand for workers will fall. So by reducing the supply of labor at a time when sort of the demand for labor will fall, you're in a situation where you're also protecting the American worker going down the line 3, 4, 5, 10 years down the line because of the changing nature of work. So, you know, this is really the president is working so many different angles with this policy and with the interplay with immigration policy and the interplay with our foreign policy, our defense policy. It's kind of breathtaking when you think about all the changes he's managing, and he's using these tools in such an aggressive, forward way that's really not like anything we've seen from a president. I think Ronald Reagan was a very, you know, active president, but a lot of that, what he was doing was focused on changing the nature of government. He's changing like everything all at once, you know?
Yeah, and I just think this was a long time coming, and we've gotten used to consumerism is in our country where, you know, we've gotten used to foreign goods coming in that are cheap and we get to go buy our flat screen TVs like I've done cheaper than we've benefited from that. I think
it's Walmart, right?
Yeah. The thing that might change now, maybe prices go up a little bit. I mean, with this new regime of tariffs and all, inflation might be a little bit more of a factor. Do you see that? And I've just got time for a couple more questions here.
Sure. No. So there may be some inflation. But it should be one time. In other words, that once people adjust to the new level, it could be a bump. But about 20% of the economy comes from imports. So it's not like you're putting this, that when you're putting a tariff on imports, it's not putting a tariff on everything you're buying. And the other thing they recognize is when you reshore the production, you're going to be doing so with new technology. It's part of the whole AI boom. And so it's entirely possible that as we build new plants with new technology, the actual cost of that will be lower. It'll be lower with fewer workers, but being paid a higher wage. So, how this plays out with inflation isn't at all clear because of the changing nature of work at the same time. So I think it's simplistic to say you're putting a tax on the American consumer. It isn't at all clear that it's actually going to be passed through. What it may actually do is generate higher incomes, which will more than outweigh any kind of increase in the price of the goods you're buying at Walmart. So, and one of the things to go back in 2019, people forget we had very high employment rates and we had rising wage rates at the median level. So the middle worker, the worker in the middle of the economy, their income was growing rapidly, and it wasn't so much at the top end. When you have a lot of inflation, people at the top end of the income spectrum make a lot more money. So this is again geared towards a middle income, median American, if you will, person in the middle, benefiting them.
Richard, I really appreciate this kind of, I think it's a tutorial, just some background information for listeners on all aspects of this tariff issue. And again, I really appreciate how you've done it in a fair way. And again, I think there's a lot of information I've found anyway that I've read, I wasn't aware of, and I keep up on things that put this issue in a different spotlight. It's not black and white. There's been a lot going on over the years that draw attention to this. I think most people would agree needs addressed. I just want to close. I've got 1 minute left. I have to ask you this. I hope you don't mind. I've seen your name mentioned as a potential Republican candidate for governor in Illinois. That election's coming up next year. Is that something that you're actively considering?
Yeah, I am looking at it, and I think that Illinois for a long time has been getting things backwards, where I think the government's ethic is that we work for the government. The government tells us what to do. And I think they got it backwards. The government should be serving us, not ruling over us. And I'd like to see if we could try something new and different, and that is try something normal. And so the question I have is, where are the people of Illinois? Are they ready for something different and something normal? Or are they really just kind of content with the kind of government they're getting today? I think that we need to rethink Illinois government. We've seen that the president's doing that with DOGE. The Illinois government's grown very rapidly, largely on federal contributions, and those are going to be drying up. And so the question is how much government do we want to pay for? And what kind of quality of government do we want to have? And what's their ethic going to be? Are they there to serve or are they there to tell you what to do? I'm sort of the view that we need to refresh the idea that government serves and doesn't rule.
Richard Porter's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. We've had an engaging discussion on tariffs. Richard is a former Illinois person on the Republican National Committee, and he's also a retired partner with Kirkland and Ellis. I think a lot of people are familiar with that firm, a famed law firm, global law firm up in Chicago. Richard, thank you so much for taking the time. I hope to have you back at some point.
Thanks. It was a pleasure. I look forward to it.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.